Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to...
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of what will eventually have a title, but we are currently calling the Next Lander Watchcast, because by the time we've recorded this, we still haven't come up with a name. That's on me.
This is going to get increasingly ridiculous, as it is going to be at least 3 weeks, probably, after this podcast debuts, before we say the name of whatever it is on the show.
What I can tell you is that by the time it goes up, it will have a name, because it has to.
Right. Yes, no, the listeners from day one will know what this thing is called, but we shouldn't.
Yeah. You know, it's a fun gag. We'll run with it as long as we can. Maybe another 5 years. This will be our five-year mission, is trying to name this podcast.
Unfortunately, still untitled, I think, is spoken for.
Yeah, that's a shame. Folks, we are back. Last week we did Jaws, our first film, and now it is time to begin our journey into our first television series for this here Watchcast. And we have chosen to go down a fascinating path, I'm going to say, right out of the gate here. We have started out with Star Trek, the original series, because Vinny has never seen Star Trek, the original series. And Brad, apparently you've never seen this series either, though you are a Star Trek fan like I am.
I mean, I should clarify, my love of Star Trek is about 99.9% focused on Next Generation, the TV series specifically, and some of the DS, the little bit of DS9 I've seen, but like I've seen next to nothing of the original series other than like catching some stuff on syndication 25 years ago.
You've seen some of the movies though, right?
I've seen, gosh, Wrath of Khan is the only, Undiscovered Country, I would say.
Okay.
Two, you know, the even ones, the good ones.
Right.
Yes. I've seen two, four, and six are like prominent enough in my memory that I could basically tell you what they're about.
Yeah. Those are the winners there. So
I've seen the movies and I've caught like the syndication of the Next Generation, all, you know, the handful of episodes. I've seen Picard play a flute, you know, like Data in a Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, right. I thought you would never seen any Next Generation or any Star
That's
Trek.
That's impossible. I crossed by a TV in the 90s. It's like, you know, but I've seen, but I couldn't tell you the episodes and I couldn't tell you the plot lines.
There's a context there that is kind of missing.
Yeah. Or like, and I think I watched one season premiere of one Star Trek that people were excited for. And it was like a face floating in a white space. And I turned it right off. It was like a premiere. It was like, maybe that was Deep Space Nine or something. And there was like a white background, like heaven. And then like a face appeared in it. And I said, what the fuck?
That does actually sound like a DS9 thing.
That kind of sounds like the Emissary, the series premiere.
Yeah.
Yes, Sisko does go to weird wormhole heaven.
Okay, and
for
then
a
I think
while
I
in the series premiere of DS9,
I looked at my brother and turned it off.
Well, here's the thing: it's going to be a long time before any of us get to wormhole heaven, where that is. DS9 is many, many seasons of television away from where we are right now, which is starting at the very beginning of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry's original brainchild.
Hang on, now we should unpack this because. Mm-hmm. You told us what you would like to do with this, and we just went along with it and didn't actually talk about the particulars, but we opted to not watch The Cage first.
Yes.
Which is the prequel? The pilot?
It is the original pilot.
So
which didn't air until after the series ended?
So it never officially aired, is the thing.
Okay.
So the original pilot, let's get a little bit of history here.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it did air and just didn't go well or something.
So the pilot was originally pitched. The show was originally pitched in 1964 by Gene Roddenberry. It was made by Desilu Productions, which is Lucille Ball's production company.
Mm.
They originally pitched it to CBS, who turned it down. And then it was pitched to NBC, who ordered the original pilot, which was The Cage, the episode that features Captain Pike and a number of other characters that do not make their way into the major series. That was turned down because it was deemed too cerebral.
Uh-huh.
So eventually they were convinced to film a second pilot, which is the episode Where No Man Has Gone Before, which we have not done yet because, like all television, they aired this stuff out of production order.
I believe it's next.
It is next. It's the next one up for this series, yes.
And
but So go ahead. Well,
so just for my historical context, this is being made in the 60s, right? This mm-hmm. is like middle of the 60s, cultural revolution, a lot of stuff going on. This Oof. Is pre Star Wars, right?
Yes.
This is by about what?
By
10
about a
years?
Decade.
Yeah. So is this is like kind of Buck Rogers land? Like we're post
so
we're post-
so Roddenberry's pitch for this thing was Wagon Train to the Stars.
Okay.
So it was actually more based on like the kind of Golden Age Western TV
I
series
got
that,
that
were happening
yeah.
at the time. It was
yeah.
like, hey, like this is like a wagon train except in space.
Okay.
Kind of thing.
All right. I just want to put this in like and you know, historically at the time, was it popular?
So just real quick before I get to that, the reason we're not watching The Cage yet
oh, okay, sure.
is because it does come back up later in this first season. There is a okay. two-part episode that references and actually shows a bunch of the events from the original pilot, and it made no sense to me to talk about that exact same plot line twice.
Okay.
So we're going to watch The Cage, but it's going to be when we watch The Menagerie, which is the two-parter midway through this season.
Okay, that makes sense. My understanding of how the original series went is that it was never super popular. They only made it to season 3, and I believe season 3 got cut short or was a truncated season to begin with.
It was. Okay.
The kind of common wisdom or the mythology is that Star Trek only really picked up in the 70s when Star Trek conventions started to be held.
That is
interesting.
True.
That it okay. actually became like a cult classic after the fact when it was in syndication and when people started getting together and
okay.
talking about how much they loved it. And that's why the movies started coming about in the late 70s, because they actually, what became the movies, don't let me ramble.
No, by all means.
What became the movies started as a project called Star Trek Phase 2, which
was
correct. Actually an attempt to just bring back the original series to TV again.
Okay.
And it was just going to have all the same crew members in it again. And some of those scripts morphed into at least, I think, the motion picture.
That's true.
But then a lot of those scripts were actually repurposed for Next Generation, just like swapping characters out.
Interesting.
Or you know, the concepts of those scripts for Phase 2 were, anyway.
And let me be clear, some of those scripts were not the best episodes of Next Generation. They definitely felt more of a kind with the original series and its tone.
So we watched two episodes here.
Yes, the two episodes, just for those at home, we have watched The Man Trap, which is the first episode that aired, and that is an episode that did do very well in the ratings. It's just that it was kind of a steep drop off from there. And then the second episode is Charlie X. So we're going to start here with The Man Trap.
You guys are not trying to like trick me into something like getting canceled on the internet. These episodes, the Man Trap and Charlie X, have a lot going on in it.
Yes.
Okay. Look,
simultaneously,
a
lot and not much.
I mean, two things. Number one, it was the mid-60s.
It was.
Number two, relatedly.
Uh-huh.
The show was considered incredibly progressive for its time.
I do know that, and I've heard a lot of that, and I've talked to, you know, there are older Star Trek fans in my family and extended family that were like, you know, very inclusive in terms of representation on the starship.
Yeah, Nichelle Nichols as Uhura was like one of the first like lead black women on a major series.
So I got a lot of that, and I think my going into it, I was like, okay. And then when you want to jump into it, let's go on The Man Trap and the 60s version of, but it's still, I guess, a product of his time.
To me, at least, the thing that was supposed to be the most profound in this was and they don't really get into this, actually. It just occurred to me that, like, Chekhov is not even in these episodes.
Yeah, he doesn't show up until season 2.
Later on, though, and like, you know, this was like directly post-World War II. I mean, I think Roddenberry maybe was a veteran of that war. You know, they had a Russian helmsman, you know, they had people from numerous different cultures on Earth,
yes,
all just working together on the bridge as if to say, like, hey, we have gotten past our
right
petty international squabbles on Earth and have united as one people.
And in the episode, we'll get into it, there is obviously some Federation and socialism stuff going on as we get into The Man Trap, where they go for their medical check-ins,
yes,
their yearly medical check-ins for all remote people on the planet.
Well, so you don't get a lot of it here in the original episodes. Like, they kind of don't give you a lot of the lore of, like, what the Federation is, like, what the history of Earth is at this point. But, like, the basic gist of it is that the United Federation of Planets is a, you know, it's a conglomeration, basically, of a bunch of different alien worlds, though.
Hmm.
And this is a recurring theme throughout the series. humans are basically the centerpiece of the whole thing. Whether they should be or not, they are.
You know, I mean, that's a problem with all science fiction productions, you know, just because special effects and makeup are expensive.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's easier to just cast human beings than it is to, you know, manufacture a bunch of suits and stuff.
And especially in this era, like, the makeup effects were not,
They're so good.
They're really something, but they are not, you know, they don't have a lot of range as far as, like, what they can depict as far as the alien species are going. Like, Spock's ears are basically the most noteworthy thing you get in either of these episodes, that and the alien in the ghillie suit. Well, but
yeah, like, even that suit is just a real carryover from just, like, the super cheesy 50s, like, UFO type stuff.
My son and daughter, my daughter got bored pretty quickly, but my son watched the whole time with us, my wife and I watched these, and he said, "Why is he an elf?" And I said, yeah, he's basically a space elf. He's a space elf.
Before we get into the meat of these episodes, like, as much as we were talking about the kind of, like, unity portrayed in the series and so forth, like, there are some things you need to know about Gene Roddenberry that will become apparent over time. Like, there's definitely still some stuff.
Is he horny?
Dude.
The man was polyamorous before polyamorous was really a thing.
He is a historic lech.
Like, yes. And, you know,
maybe,
like,
not in a good way.
No, like, sexist. Like, the man had very sexist attitudes toward women in a lot of ways.
Let's hold off. Don't Google any Gene Roddenberry quotes.
No.
Let's say.
Okay.
Like, do not look up Gene Roddenberry's definition of a good time until we're a few more episodes into this.
Okay. I will refrain. I will let this work speak for him. And there's plenty to speak about.
Yes, there is.
For me, like, I don't know if it's a coincidence or not that my all-time favorite Star Trek came about directly after he was out of the picture.
Yes, that is accurate.
Like, literally, like, the second he exited the production actively, things got way better. Anyway.
That said, I don't want to, like, completely poison the well here. I want to say that there are episodes of Star Trek, the original series, that I think are genuinely great. And some of them are in the season, some of them are, I think more of them are in the next season. But this show is just all over the place in terms of quality. Like, it is a real rough run they have through those three seasons that hit some real low lows, but also some pretty high highs over time.
I am really excited to see all those highs, like, all the best stuff, because I've heard about it for years, you know? Like, some of the episode titles of the series are so legendary, like, you can't know about science fiction and not, you know, like, I've wondered forever and ever what The City on the Edge of Forever is about, because, like, that is, like, that's the coolest, like, most sort of classical and elegant science fiction title of anything I've ever heard.
Titles is actually one thing this series does do very well. They are extremely melodramatic throughout the entire series.
For sure. Anyway.
All right.
Should we get into it?
Let's get into it. Let's start with episode one, The Man Trap. This is an episode that was originally sixth, I think, in the production order.
Okay.
Eventually decided to make the premiere because they liked the horror plot. The TV executives did.
Okay.
William Shatner is on record saying he thought this was the worst of the original episodes and did not like it as a launching point. But, you know, it was what... They were just trying to find something that popped and really kind of got things going right from the jump.
So this is this kind of jumped you right into with Kirk, who they kind of established as the captain by dint of him doing all the voiceover, right?
Yes.
Is just basically saying, "Captain's log. We're gonna jump. We're doing a recon on this planet to go do the yearly physicals for the research post." Just so happens, as it happens, an ex-fling from Dr. McCoy is also on this planet, which, you know, and they bring what I know, because I know some Star Trek lore, is in all essences a red shirt, even though they're not wearing a red shirt, right?
Yes, the concept of the red shirt exists from the jump, even if they are not wearing the correct costuming. But yes, so this woman and this scientist are on this barren planet doing some kind of archaeology. I don't know if they were supposed to have had more of a team at one point or not, but it is really just these two people on this barren ass planet, and they're coming down.
Lot.
Yeah, this Hollywood. There's a lot of backlot studio stuff that you're gonna see throughout this series.
Okay, let me just pause you here for a second, because my son, who's 10, but as soon as he saw the rocks, he's like, "Those are styrofoam."
Yes,
and I said, "Wow, couldn't even fool a 10-year-old for 5 seconds."
No, it's great styrofoam, to be fair. I kind of love the production design of this episode, even if it is incredibly cheap.
Yeah, it's great.
But so, okay, so this episode was written by George Clayton Johnson, who wrote a number of Twilight Zone episodes and also wrote the novel Logan's Run.
Okay, that's interesting to hear, because like the 10 minutes into this thing, I was ready to come in here and just be like, boy, this feels like a Twilight Zone episode.
Totally. Yeah, he wrote like 10 episodes of the Twilight Zone. This is the only Star Trek episode he ever wrote. He did some...
Oh, really?
He did some writing on some other episodes, but it was not used, ultimately.
Because I was going to say, the next one we talk about just is a Twilight Zone episode.
Yes.
But he did not write that one.
He did not do
the next one. Like, the plot of the next one is lifted directly. Yes. Yes, but...
So yeah, they go to this planet, and you know, it is suddenly made apparent that the woman that Dr. McCoy had a relationship with at some point appears different to different people.
Yes,
and so much so that the red shirt's like, "Hey, you look like a girl I met on what do you call it, the Pleasure Planet."
Something wrong, Darnell?
Oh, excuse me, sir, but. Ma'am, if I didn't know better, I would swear that you were somebody I left behind on Wrigley's Pleasure Planet. It's funny, you're exactly like a girl that...
A little less mouth, Darnell.
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't mean to, I mean, I know it's impossible, of course.
Why don't you step outside, Darnell?
Yes, sir.
Yes. The concept of the Pleasure Planet will come up later again. It's a recurring theme in Star Trek.
Like I said, there's some stuff about Roddenberry.
Yeah.
On the Pleasure Planet, Kirk is like, yeah, why don't you step outside for me? Because Bones shoots him some daggers. Mm-hmm. And then,
rightfully so.
And it's like, why don't we go outside for a little
while? Well, he spoke out of turn.
Yeah.
No, he did. It wasn't his turn.
He's a crewman who inserted himself into officer. But like, I was actually like, so hang on, let me back up here. Mm-hmm. Vinny brought something up before we started watching this about his perception of James Kirk that I was really interested and surprised to hear, which is essentially like the spoofs of Kirk that have permeated the culture since this series in some way have almost overtaken like what Kirk was actually about, which is to say like the Zaff Brannigans and like the parodies of Kirk kind of, you know, have sent the message that Kirk was like some kind of lovable goofball, like hapless doof kind of. I guess what I'm trying to say is when I got into this, I was surprised to see how kind of military and all business Kirk is in this.
So here's the thing. Kirk as portrayed, at least in the episodes that I remember seeing, I've seen most of this series, but a lot of it was a long time ago. But like my recollection is that Kirk is treated like he is the greatest captain in the fucking universe. Like,
well, yeah, of course.
Like he is the most capable. He is the most on his toes, able to sort of like adapt and come up with crazy ideas kind of person that they all just kind of work out because he's fucking James Kirk and that's just what he does. Yeah,
but my perception is like, again, this is going into it without a lot of so my preconceived notion is he's cavalier to a fault and only gets by through the actual his crew members being competent, right?
Shatner. Okay, I think it like, but Kirk, There are a number of times throughout the series where Kirk is the only person who can solve this, the only person who has the right idea of how to deal with the situation. But there are also plenty of episodes where it is kind of like, hey, Spock is the only one who really knows what's going on here, or, you know, James Doohan, you know, has to sort of like bebop his way through an engineering problem and then does it. But Kirk is always kind of the focal point around which everything else orbits.
For sure. I mean, just in these early episodes, though, like, I guess what I'm trying to get across is, like, just in terms of his characterization, he's just more of a hard ass than I expected. I think maybe that softens a little later on.
It does. He eventually gets to be a little less of a, you know, I'm giving everyone shit character.
Right.
But, like
just barking orders at everybody.
But here, like, him and DeForest Kelly, like, there's a few moments where they are just straight up, like, at each other in a way that is interesting as, like, an introduction to both characters.
Yeah, I don't think from this first episode that Kirk is a very good captain. I mean, he loses about 4 crew members and then brings an alien life form inadvertently onto the ship where it continues to run rampant. And, you know, we'll get into this next episode later, but is this a theme of Kirk? Kirk doesn't have control of his ship at any really given time, that it is just constant. If you're on the Enterprise, you are basically part of a Petri dish.
I mean, if you think of this in the time in which it was created, Star Trek is basically a 1960s workplace. It is completely out of control. There is, like, rampant sexism going on.
I literally, like, casual workplace sexism is the phrase I was going to bring in here.
And the white men in charge are barely holding things together. Occasionally they get it right, but often it is by virtue of the, you know, the other people around them that ultimately they solve the problems. But yeah.
So in the Man Trap, it turns out that this monster, which is never really quite defined, it turns out it is a species indigenous to the planet.
Yes, indigenous to the planet, but all but died out.
All but died out. She's the last of her kind, says the a man who is living with
yes, the scientist who has basically taken up a life on this planet with this alien, which I'm pretty sure killed the woman.
Yes.
And Need took her salt. Place.
He says it was the actual wife would have understood. She needed the salt.
It just hit me, even just having watched Next Generation primarily, how much the like lone scientist who's posted more or less by himself on a planet who is super crotchety and wants to be left alone and is hiding a secret is like an archetype of this series.
Definitely.
There's at least three or four of those just in Next Generation, now that I think about it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a recurring theme. It doesn't feel like the most efficient way for the Federation to be doing its science projects, like just send every salty asshole you don't know what to do with out to some barren planet to see what rocks are there. But, like, it keeps happening, and they're getting results, clearly, so...
So this creature needs salt. so much salt. Constantly, it's impossible for me to know how this species ever survived on this barren planet unless there was some horrible climate disaster on it.
I think that's alluded to.
That changed the entire salt composition. So the creature is constantly sucking salt out of crew members.
It's a salt vampire, basically.
It's a salt vampire assaulting the crew. But also has a mechanic built in that is like seems just there for some narrative where it can take the form of your thoughts and desires, but also alluded to that it needs love to survive.
Well, I don't know that it actually needs love. I think it just kind of wants love.
Craves,
it wants to be
emotions.
Cared for because it's been alone on this planet, presumably for a long time.
They get into that philosophically where they refer to it as a beast a bunch of times, you know, but then they say, like, it's not just an unthinking beast. It's intelligent like we are. Like, we are also thinking animals, and so is it.
Yes. So it can appear to you as a desire or a memory, because it appears to Uhura as, like, a desire, right?
Yeah, but as a really hot dude.
As a really hot dude that is then like cornering her on the ship. And then it appears to McCoy as this woman he had a relationship with. It appears to Kirk as his mom. I don't know, like.
Appears to Kirk as the older version of that woman.
But like, why?
Well, so I think the reason being that like she was trying to, or the creature was trying to appeal to McCoy's memory of that person.
Uh-huh.
And since Kirk has never met this person, it doesn't have to do that. It can just be what Kirk expects the older version of that woman to kind of look like.
Okay, so it can also project unrelated to the subject's thoughts, whatever it wants.
Yeah, it can kind of be anything to anyone.
Okay. I
mean, this is where the Twilight Zone-esque kind of morality play stuff comes in with this show, is like, any weird magical power stuff like this is just there to be expedient for the plot.
Absolutely.
Right. It's not there to make sense.
Right.
You know, conceptually, it's just like to advance whatever thematic point they're trying to make.
And there are aspects of this they did look into. Like Gene Roddenberry specifically asked some scientists, like, if someone sucked all the salt out of your body, what would happen? And apparently you would die very quickly. So that you looked into that at least.
So
you
would
look
says,
totally normal, I guess.
Well, except for your sucker marks later. And they pull out some like Silence of the Lambs butterfly plant or something from the guy's throat, and they're like, oh, he must have eaten the yum yum fruit or whatever of this planet and died. And it turns out to be no. And then, they send more people down, even though people are dying. And Kirk's a bad captain. And then they find another dead body. And then the creature takes the form of a crew member that has been killed but not discovered, and sneaks aboard the ship, but suddenly stops talking to anybody, even though it is very intelligent and can communicate very, very well all the time. starts doing this weird thing where it just won't talk to anybody and creeps. What is it, Janice?
Like, yeah, it creeps on Janice. Okay, look, creeping on Janice, I'm going to tell you right now, Janice Rand got one of the most bum raps of any character in anyone in the Star Trek universe. Grace Lee Whitney.
Yeoman Rand.
So like, Yeoman Rand is like a famous name. Like, I had no idea who she was because they don't really introduce her well. But
they
like,
don't introduce her well, and also she's gone midway through this season.
Right.
I thought she was there the whole series, but when I saw the name in the credits, I was like, oh my god, that was Yeoman Rand. Like, I've heard that name forever.
I think we'll talk more about Rand and Charlie X, because there's definitely more of her in that episode, and what happens to her is more emblematic of what that where that character went in the original series, but...
I was wondering if it was just a coincidence that these two episodes got jammed together at the front, or she's just treated like this in every single episode.
She's not treated well, generally speaking, in the original series, but... So yeah, like, the thing about... two things about this, this now... creature walking around as this dude. One, this actor looks like he fronted the best indie band of 2005. that was my immediate takeaway from his whole vibe. And yes, it is weird that he kind of stops talking, but I think the implication is that it is so salt-starved at this point that it doesn't really know how to do anything other than lustily look at salt shakers.
Yeah. Like, because, I mean, I was, you know, again, they were saying, like, oh, it's an intelligent beast, but I was like, is it? Because it
seems
they've kind of
lost it.
It hasn't figured out that if it could just stop killing people for 5 minutes, that they would probably just give it all the salt it needs, right? But
right, just go to the kitchen. Like, the salt shaker is like, you know, they can make you some salt. It seems like they have plenty of salt going around. You don't have to suck it out of people.
Well, so keep in mind, there is a concept that is introduced later on in Star Trek, which is the replicator, which is the thing that can make any sort of matter, which is basically the thing that feeds anyone on a Federation starship up to this point. That does not exist yet here, I don't think.
Does that ever come into the original series, or is that because it's definitely all over the Next Generation?
I don't remember it coming up in the original series. I think because they talk a lot about like supply runs and like, you know, there's a cook on the ship who is doing a lot of stuff. So,
I mean, I know we're not going to watch Next Generation here anytime soon, but like I couldn't help making all these comparisons where this feels much more like a submarine.
Yes.
Oh.
Like, there's a lot of like exposed piping everywhere and like it's purely military for the most part. And like, Even the Enterprise and Next Generation is very much like city in space with
kids,
and it's very sleek and like a lot of curved lines, and this is just like rugged ass industrial ship, you know?
Totally.
It's very naval. Like, even the hailing sounds like it's from a submarine, that whistle,
all the terminology they use to kind of like, you know, insert into what space fleet is like is all naval terminology.
Yeah. I mean, it's what is like the UNN in the UNN? Is
even
it
USS?
Is it USS? I thought it's like UNSS. Is it just
no, it's
USS?
Just USS. USS Enterprise.
Wait, yeah. Like United States?
No.
It's not. I forget what the USS actually stands for in Federation terms, but it is not. Because the United States exists in
is
this
it
world.
United Stars ship?
Maybe so, but like, so the thing with this is that Earth at this point has countries, but it is not governed that way. Like, all the countries are essentially just regions on Earth.
It's like a super government.
But there is an Earth president. Like, the humanity as a whole has come together at this point. And while they are, again, way overrepresented for what is supposed to be a multitude of different alien species in this Federation, there are other aliens living on Earth, and there are humans living all over the galaxy. That's the other thing I should emphasize here. All of this takes place in the Milky Way. Everything in Star Trek pretty much takes place in the Milky Way. Nothing really happens outside our galaxy.
Oh, definitely not. In fact, like, even at the time,
not to get too far
here
ahead.
Here I go. Even in Next Generation, they've only mapped like something like 20-something percent of the Milky Way. Like, the vast majority of the galaxy is still unknown to humans.
Yeah.
So the creature kind of goes around, kills a bunch of other crew members.
Still looking for salt.
Only about 3/4 through the episode do they realize the creature's on the ship finally by having this kind of ambush of the lone scientist on the planet finally to some good like Spock crawling on his elbows and
the fucking dive that William Shatner does, like, or he does his little like, you know, stomach crawl. It's so cute. It's adorable.
It's pretty adorable. Like, they're playing in the sandbox, and they finally figure out what's going on there. You know, not to mention, you know, again throughout the thing, what do they say about Yeoman Rin. I know we're talking more about her tonight. Oh, imagine having your own personal yeoman, huh?
Hey, Janice. Is that for me?
Don't you wish it was?
How about that?
Yeah, how'd you like to have her as your own personal yeoman?
Mm-hmm.
As she's strutting around. And then you find out...
That scene in particular, I felt like I was watching an episode of Mad Men.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly.
Like a show that intends to emphasize that kind of behavior versus here is a show of the era that just concludes it as a matter of course.
There's might as well have had like Aruga.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Oh, there's a lot of that. And I also do find it really funny that when I'm on the ship, there is just a yeoman that's going around bringing everyone their appetizer plate.
I meant to bring this up. I can't remember which episode it's in that Kirk is straight up snacking
on
the bridge.
Yeah, that's yes. The one. He's just like sitting there eating little cubes of food.
First of all, Picard would never let anybody eat on the bridge.
No, God,
but no. But then also, second of all, he finishes his little snack, and yes, there's
somebody with a tray.
A miniskirt just standing there with a tray that he just puts his dirty dishes on.
Yes. Also, all the clothing in that is like looks like it went through. I mean, I understand it's of the time, but looks like it went through the dryer a couple of times.
Oh,
like
yeah.
The hiked up pants and the
skirts are definitely
shirts.
A little short. And yeah. I have always really loved the pants and boot design of original series Star Trek. The weird, like, kind of slack at the bottom over the boot, but also the really high fucking like standard issue heeled boot.
Yeah.
Is your fucking that is the thing you are bringing on your military missions in space. Doesn't seem like the smartest way to go.
Crushed velvet or velour shirts. It's all very stylish.
Yeah.
Another part I really liked about this episode what is George Takei at this point? Is he like a lieutenant?
He is, I believe he's an ensign initially.
Yes, I believe that's right.
And he starts out, I think in the one that's coming up, I think he's a physicist in that episode in Where No Man Has Gone Before,
okay.
But he becomes the pilot very quickly. They just basically turn him into the helmsman.
Yes,
okay.
He is an ensign, yes.
So he's in the room with the plant, right?
Oh, this is so good.
And the plant that is the most hand... More hand than plant, just a full open palm with some feathers on it that is gobbling out Sesame Street style from like its vase that can detect, you know, the creature in the room. Like, it is bizarre.
What if I told you even the plant was involved in sexual harassment in this episode? Because apparently the guy who was the puppeteer could see up Rand's skirt while he was doing it and was acting like a shithead the whole time.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Yeah.
No,
even that
no
can't
thanks.
Just be an innocent, stupid thing. Like, there has to be some weird, dark detail to it.
Yeah, I never trusted that plant.
No, that plant, and it's also just the stupidest looking fucking thing.
It's
like,
so good and bad. I learned that Vulcans have different blood salts because of, I guess, the oceans on the planet. Is why
they have green blood.
Why Spock? Does he mention green blood on this? When he gets hit.
Yeah, when he gets hit. He has green blood. That is a detail that apparently Roddenberry did not like, but they stuck with it, and Vulcans just have green blood forever.
He also gets, like, a bedazzled Band-Aid, which is maybe also a sparkly Band-Aid on his head after he gets hit, which was also very dapper, I thought.
Speaking of weird like wardrobe and effect choices, what is with the little metal corn cob shaped thing that everybody's got in their ear in this? Like,
oh,
that's
my
not
gosh.
Something that persisted, is it?
Are you talking about the thing that like Uhura uses for communications?
Yes, the communicator.
Uhura
Spock.
Has it. Spock has
yes.
it. Yes.
So
least
they
one
that
scene.
No that
like,
does
it's
persist.
Huge. Wait, in the whole series?
Yeah. So Uhura
How
has
that
forever.
That?
Does it get smaller? Because like, that looks like a lot of weight on your ear.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they changed the design or not. I don't remember if they changed it or not. But yeah, so the big thing about the communications aspect of that is that Uhura always has that thing in her ear. I don't think Spock always has it.
Okay.
But that is like part of her communications job is that she has that thing in her ear. That's how she listens.
I guess it's intended to be some kind of antenna or something. It's a sizable piece of metal.
Yes. Yes. I saw you see Spock take it off and it looks like it has a brace behind it. So I guess that's how it like stays in the ear because that thing, it looks like somebody stuck a microphone in their ear.
I do.
Had it sit there.
As dated as it is, I do still really love this original bridge design, like kind of the industrial design of it. And also just like the screens that do nothing but show stuff from psychedelic fucking, you know, pot parties on them. Like that. That is an aspect that I do enjoy still about this original series is just how incredibly 60s everything looks.
Yeah, I think we should probably mention here that all of us are watching the remastered HD version that's got all the redone special effects.
Yes.
Yeah, it's some things are very sharp, like shots of the Enterprise.
So the reason
it does not feel like they graded the effects that they composited it in to match the footage very well. Like that stuff stands out as extremely clean in a lot of cases.
Yes, it does. It's mostly the ship model design stuff is where you see a lot of it. There are a couple of other, I think, effect shots here and there that get the same treatment, but a lot of it is just literally just like, hey, the ship, we made a better ship model using CG.
Or Starfields.
Yeah, like, Starfields, like that kind of stuff.
Very clean. There is a problem with focus on a lot of shots, and I think sometimes intentionally soft focus or some Vaseline on the lens, and sometimes they just didn't find the focus when they got the shot.
Yeah, there's some focus issues. You can see a whole lot of that, like, we are using that little light thing to beam in on a character's eyes. Like
The
Morticia Adams thing. Yeah, the thing that was basically a joke in the Addams Family movies. They just use for real here, liberally.
Which I like. It's like nicely lit a lot of times. They're very dramatic, but sometimes they'll shoot to a reaction shot that's just did not have the focus pulled correctly on it. And, you know, listen, that's tough. They're shooting on film. It's, I'm sure, on a budget, and it was, we're not doing reshoots.
Well, and also part of the reason... You'll notice it more when we watch the other pilot. The costume design is a little bit different, and everything kind of looks a little bit different. They changed it after the second pilot because color TVs were essentially becoming much more widespread at this point. And the studio or the network was like, we want a show that pops for people who are buying color televisions.
Okay.
And that's why they changed a lot of the uniform design to be more colorful and to add more color kind of to the background of everything.
Interesting. I just attributed that to like 60s psychedelic kind of influence.
It's that too, but like both pilots have fairly muted costume design, and like the backgrounds aren't nearly as like deep reds, deep purples, that kind of stuff. So yeah.
So this kind of concludes with a showdown, right?
Where, yes.
At
some
McCoy...
point they gave Quaaludes to Dr. McCoy so that the monster could be Dr. McCoy for a while, and then it all comes to a head in Dr. McCoy's cabin
the scientist pays for his obstinance by dying.
Yes
And then wait no, it's not this one. I was gonna say we'll get into that in Charlie X, some of the chess stuff, and then there's a showdown and a pretty ridiculous fight against the monster, and then it's McCoy who has to shoot the beast.
Like the hand-to-hand stuff in this series is legendary for being ridiculous for the most part, but like I enjoyed that moment of tension, like that turmoil, like where he just could not bring himself to shoot his lost love or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was like shocked at how languid some of the editing is in this thing. Like that scene just felt like it went on forever.
It does.
It was just like reaction shot, a reverse reaction shot, like back and forth between characters for like what felt like an eternity before something actually happened.
Yeah, it goes on, and it's there's a recurring line that I feel like Kirk keeps throwing it at Dr. McCoy of like, you got to stop thinking with your loins. You got to stop, basically accusing him of being too horny, which is maybe the most pot calling the kettle black thing before anyone knows that the kettle is black yet, because throughout this series, nobody is hornier than James T. Kirk.
Is there a subplot in these early ones where Uhura is like trying to hit on Spock and just can't break through?
Their relationship is kind of alluded to. I don't think it ever gets that explicit.
Okay.
It becomes more explicit in the J.J. Abrams movies later on.
Okay, because there's a scene in this one, and there's a scene in Charlie X where it seems like she is trying to flirt and trying to break through the Vulcan veneer.
Yeah.
But I can't tell.
I mean,
where that's going.
That's kind of your introduction to Spock here, is him being kind of cold and like Uhura getting really pissed about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That felt to me like a way to really just highlight how detached he is.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the first anybody's ever seen of him.
And you know the thing with Vulcans, right, Vinny?
They're pure logic.
They're pure logic. They have essentially advanced their species, evolved over time to stifle their emotional responses to everything.
Yeah, it's not that they don't have them, they just killed them. Also, I thought you were going to bring up Ponfar here.
No. That will come up later in this series, so...
Okay.
There's a scene in the beginning where she's like, kind of waxing poetically about stuff, and he's like, well, I don't do poetic.
I mean,
stuff.
It's like so blatant. Like their literal first interaction is her like explaining how to make small talk to him.
Yes.
Like they could not beat you over the head anymore with like Like, this character does not understand basic social interactions.
Mr. Spock, sometimes I think if I hear that word frequency once more, I'll cry.
Cry?
I was just trying to start a conversation.
Well, since it is illogical for a communications officer to resent the word frequency, I have no answer.
No, you have an answer. I'm an illogical woman who's beginning to feel too much a part of that communications council. Why don't you tell me I'm an attractive young lady, or ask me if I've ever been in love? Tell me how your planet Vulcan looks on a lazy evening when the moon is full.
Vulcan has no moon, Miss Uhura.
I'm not surprised, Mr. Spock.
Yes, and then later on, when Kirk is coming back with a dead crew member, and Spock has the helm, and Spock is just like, great, okay, I'll see you.
Let's get to work.
Which is like, what are you talking? Somebody's dead. I thought that line, and he's like, it doesn't change what I have to do.
Or something like me being upset about that will not change the fact of it or something.
I don't believe it.
Explain.
You explain. That means that somebody is dead and you just sit there. It could be Captain Kirk. He's the closest thing you have to a friend.
Lieutenant, my demonstration of concern will not change what has happened. The transporter room is very well manned and they will call me if they need my assistance.
Also, it's understandable to have that line at the beginning. I think it kind of makes sense. But considering how many people will die on this ship over the next 3 years, actually, Spock might be right about this.
She does say it is a line in this, which, you know, has become the first episode where she does say, like, Kirk is your only friend on here, or is like basically your best friend. And like, you're not showing any emotion, which is, you know, a setup, I guess. I at this point, I think I know that they're friends because I've seen the movie. But I've never understood if it's a friendship developed over time or if it's a begrudging friendship or, you know, respect.
Yeah, I mean, where we are at this point, they've been on this mission for a bit. Kirk has been captain for a bit. I don't know the exact number of years that they've already been doing this, but, like, it is implied right from the get-go, yes, they are friends. This is the person that Spock is closest to in the universe, so...
So they have this fight, and then they in the first episode... of this mission of exploration,
and
I guess.
Discovery.
Discovery, they have made a species extinct.
Yep. That's
congratulations.
It.
So what, three to four people have died, and they have made a species extinct. Maybe more than that.
It was really hanging on by a thread there. There was only one left. They weren't going to procreate anytime soon, so.
Space is dangerous. Sometimes you got to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
I guess that whole archaeology outpost is now shuttered. A species is extinct, and three to four crew members are dead.
Well, don't worry, because they bring back those creatures in Star Trek Online eventually, so there's more of them somewhere.
Wait, they found?
They found some more, just for a raid boss.
And then kind of pretty much credits there, and like,
the 5-year mission continues.
Sorry, get back in. Yeah. And that's the man trap, which, it sets up a lot there.
It does set up a lot, but it also does kind of drop you in just expecting you to just understand a lot. You know, you don't know much, like Dr. McCoy was a late addition. He wasn't in the original, in either of the pilots, I don't think. But then, you know, they kind of bring him on after that. It kind of sets up most of the crew, but Janice Rand, who we'll talk about more here in a second, is not going to be long for this series, but she is in a lot of these early episodes.
But there's no Scotty, no Chekhov.
I was trying to think, is it just Scotty and Chekhov from the kind of classic crew that didn't make it into this?
Not into this episode. So James Doohan is in this season, but Chekhov is not.
Huh.
I think Scotty's in Charlie X.
Scott, he's barely in it.
He's a background at the teleporter, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, the transporter?
No speaking role?
He says, like, I think he just gives an aye-aye, and, like, that's about it.
Wow.
I think. My wife pointed him out.
Yeah. He becomes much more prominent pretty soon.
Yeah. So we move on to Charlie X?
Yes, let's take a quick breather here, and then we're going to talk about Charlie X. All right, folks, episode 2 is Charlie X, an episode that goes right headlong into the old sci-fi trope of kid gets magic powers, doesn't know what to do with them because he's a dumbass kid and is awful, right?
This is
so awful. Like, I know I was supposed to be more Twilight Zone episode. Well, yes, yeah. It absolutely is. Like, I probably was supposed to be more objective about this, but like, man, I despise this kid by the end of this.
I mean, you're not supposed to like him in any way, shape, or form, but
I was getting genuinely angry watching it.
Yeah, that's fair. So this episode was, sorry, I'm just gonna give a little bit of historical information here before we get into it. This is written by Dorothy Fontana, who is a story editor on the series.
DC Fontana.
Yes.
She is credited because women were not could not use their real names.
She ends up doing about 10 episodes of this series, but also goes on to write some Next Generation, a little bit of Deep Space Nine, as well as some Babylon 5, as well as a lot of other television throughout the years. Heavy hitter, as far as this stuff is concerned.
For sure.
And then Robert Walker is the actor who plays Charlie, Jamaica Queen's own. He was in a ton of 60s through 80s television, plus some small movie roles. Like, he had a small role in Easy Rider. But he both Dorothy and Robert both passed away recently in 2019.
Okay. R.I.P.
R.I.P. But so, yeah, this is about them finding this boy. Another ship found this boy on this planet that was supposed to house this mythical species of, let's just call them green ghosts. Who have incredible psychic powers.
No, you need to call them by their names, because it took me until the end of the episode to understand what the hell they were saying.
Oh, what are they called?
A planet of Phasians?
Phasians.
Phasians.
It's TH.
Phasians.
Phasians. I did not have subtitles on, so okay. Yes. It's a planet full of Phasians. Phasians. I'm sorry, what? Phasians.
Yes.
It's like, okay.
I started to say, what were the executives thinking, but what are executives ever thinking? Like, jamming two episodes together at the front of the series that are basically the exact same plot. Like lone survivor pulled from planet who has secret magic powers.
What if I told you this is not the only episode of this series that does... these are not the only ones that do this.
You don't say.
So, Charlie was on a ship some years ago, 14 years ago to be exact. That ship crashed on this planet. He was the only survivor at 3 years old. He was taken in by these Thasians. But
You don't know that necessarily.
You don't know that initially. Yeah. You just know that he has survived on this planet, and he has come away a little askew.
Yeah.
This ship that found him cannot wait to get rid of this motherfucker.
That was a pretty funny scene when they're in the teleporter.
James T. Kirk apparently not the greatest at reading tone in conversation, because he does not understand that they are desperate to dump this motherfucker.
I don't feel like that paints them in the best light to dump this kid on the Enterprise and not give them any heads up about how much trouble he's going to be.
Well, they try, and then it doesn't quite work out
for
them.
They try to hint at it, but that's the thing, is that Charlie has powers. Charlie is powerful. Charlie could basically wipe them out with a thought if he wants to.
And he does, right? Like,
when
the ship finally does is like, hey, and the ship is exploded, or what does he say? I just eliminated the warped deflector panel or whatever.
They're going to explode anyway.
They're going to explode. Oh, like, okay.
I just took care of it for him.
So the thing is, two things I noticed in the beginning of this. One, why is Kirk in his party clothes? Why is he in his, like, Link cosplay clothes in this episode with his, like, he's got some,
like, slightly more green shirt.
And he's got laurel wreaths kind of around the collar and a belt.
I wonder, is that the equivalent of the Picard open jacket thing of, like, he's off duty and this is kind of, like, semi-leisure clothes or something?
I'm not sure they ever codify exactly why Kirk is dressed in one shirt or another at any given time, but he is the one that has the most fluid uniform mechanics throughout the series. Like, everyone else kind of gets a thing and then they just kind of stick with it after that. But, like, he kind of alternates between shirts, if I remember correctly.
To the extent that Kirk is presumably some kind of Roddenberry self-insert, I guess it's not surprising that, of course, he's going to hang out in some leisure wear.
Yeah.
He's McCoy has a slightly different shirt, but it just looks like he couldn't find the one that they used for the cast one. They had to pull one off a rack and stick a Star Trek insignia on it.
So the fun fact is that DeForest Kelly gets the best drip of anyone from this era of Star Trek, but not until much later. Until, like, the movies.
And the other thing is, like, okay, Charlie's got special powers. Charlie can use his mind.
Charlie's a 17-year-old boy.
Charlie's a 17-year-old boy.
Who's been raised on a planet, mostly by himself.
He's mostly an asshole.
He's a huge asshole.
Like, but he's like never seen a woman before. Like,
yes, never seen a corporeal person since he was
not,
three.
I guess like that other ship not
raised
so,
by a computer.
Not, well, I think not it, so I think great.
I think it's implied that the other ship is all men. It's only like 20, a crew of 20 or something
small
like that.
Small crew.
It's like a space trucking operation, basically.
But when Charlie gets mad, and I think Charlie's always angry, he rolls his eyes into the back of his head and like shoves his face chin down into his neck, and in the most like, yes, we get it. No, you're using. What are you doing? Like you're angry.
Using your mind powers. We know you're making a Will Forte face. Like that is the thing. I cannot take him seriously when he does this because he just looks like Will Forte doing a character. It's impossible.
I'm a demon.
It's really over the top. And Charlie is just angry. He's an angry lad who is lustful and very horny.
Yes. And does not know what to do with any of that energy, so he instead decides to start directing it at the woman he has instantly fallen in love with, who is, once again, Yeoman Rand.
Can we take a moment to just say, Yeoman Rand's hair is amazing.
Oh my god, that...
It's like thatched. I don't know what you call it.
Crosshatched or something. Like, I don't know how to describe that pattern, but I was like, oh my god, how long did that take to do?
There's so much braiding happening there. It's incredible. It is also one of the only things critics remarked upon regarding her performance in the 60s when they were writing about this show.
Was her hair. Oh, okay. Well, I think she's an amazing actress as well, with also some hair that is top notch. And Charlie is immediately creeping on her.
Yes. Redlining the creep factor right from the get-go.
Which leads to maybe, out of these two episodes, the most ridiculous thing. Even with a salt monster and a kid that rolls his eyes back into the back of his head to use powers, which is he smacks her in the ass, and then she has to be like, whoa, hey.
Dude, we don't do that.
And then has to be like, and he's like, wait, why? And he's like, Go talk to Kirk about it.
Charlie?
I thought... Don't be angry, I didn't... I wanted...
Charlie, you... You just don't go around slapping girls on the... It's okay, but just don't do it again.
Be angry.
Look, why don't you... Tell Captain Kirk or Dr. McCoy what you did, and they'll explain it to you, okay?
Oh my god, this ship needs fucking HR like nobody's business. It needs some... Because Kirk is not the one to go talk to about this.
So here's the thing about this. Obviously, remarkably sexist to just like throw this out there right from the jump. At the same time, them actually admonishing the kid for doing that...
Uh-huh.
Is almost more progressive than most other television of this era.
Yeah, like it's portrayed as being something wrong from the get-go, you know?
But the fact that Kirk can't explain it to him without just, like, fumbling his words is maybe not the best reflection of him.
I mean, you know, that's preceded by the scene where it's him and Bones and Spock? Or maybe just him and Bones?
I think it's like, just him and Bones.
There's, like, a heated argument back and forth of, like, all right, who's going to have to be the father figure for this kid? Like, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Like, you're the captain. You're much more of a, you know.
That's what he needs, a strong father figure.
I'd like you to give him the necessary medical orientation on the problems of adolescence.
Well, don't you think it'd be better for a strong father image like you? He already looks up to you.
The job is yours, Bone. Flattery will get you nowhere.
I mean, I think that was just trying to highlight, like, God, this is another thing that like carried over to Picard, right? That he's just like kind of uncomfortable around kids, or like not uncomfortable like being a role model for young people or something. I don't know.
Well, so the thing, and this is a difference that doesn't really come up that much until Next Generation, but the thing is, this version of the Enterprise does not house families. It does not house kids.
Yeah, it's like a military vessel.
It's basically, I mean, it's an exploration vessel, but it is also a military vessel. By the time they get to Next Generation, they go from having about like 300 or 400 crewmates on here to over 1,000, and they just have families on there. Like, it's a pretty stark difference. So here, anytime a kid shows up, it is kind of uncomfortable because it is not what they are used to dealing with. Even irrespective of the fact that Charlie is just fucking wretched.
And, you know, there's a lot of people in the background often walking around in like tinfoil radiation suits working on stuff that looks
very
dangerous.
There are just pipes everywhere and Jeffrey's tubes you could just fall into. Like, it's not safe.
So when Charlie goes to figure out how to operate around humans, other humans, Kirk really is at a loss for words, and he says something like, he's like, "There's a, you know, there's no right way to hit a woman." It's not, what'd you say? There's no right way to hit a woman. It's not like guys, which is just, and he has a really hard time. And Charlie's like, "Well, why not?" And he's like, "I, you know, I really, really can't. I don't."
Well, there are things you can do with a lady, Charlie, that you, well, there's no right way to hit a woman. I mean, man to man is one thing. But man and woman, it's another thing.
It's, I mean, just... and again, I'm damning with very faint praise here, because it's not really, he doesn't really have much to offer here, but this is the era of, you know, Sean Connery Bond, just slapping mm-hmm. women around and just being fucking, you know, shitheel to the delight of audiences. So even acknowledging, like, hey, don't slap this fucking woman on the ass that you don't know, like, for God's sakes, what are you doing?
Uh-huh.
Not, it's not good, but at least they're trying, is what I'm going to say.
At least it is framed as inappropriate.
Yes.
Unlike the catcalling in the hallways from the other crewmen.
Which they cannot get away from. It's just like, there's horny dudes all over this ship, and it's not great.
So there's a scene at which... I'm sure you guys all love as well, and it has to be, if we're talking horny scenes.
This is a legendary scene, if it's the one I'm thinking you're
the gym about. Scene?
That was not the one I was thinking of, but this is also a legendary scene, yes.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the harp playing scene. Oh,
the harp is fantastic, but the shirt off Kirk getting tussling around.
In his Starfleet issue tights.
And it's tiny, and his super tight tights, and like, you know, I'm sure, and I talked to my wife about this, of like, oh, it, you know, he's not, I'm sure at the time he's cast as a leading man who's like muscular and built, but he's got that like 50s muscle man build, right? That is just like kind of normal guy, you know, build, not like The Rock, right? So like he's shirtless and he's like, you know, he's a fit guy, but he's not like, it's not looks, creatined out, you know, muscles bulging all over the place.
No, he looks like a loaf of bread in the plastic, not just like a bunch of fucking, like the muscle definition of that time was not,
it's very
unless
different.
You were a bodybuilder, you didn't look like that.
Right, so like, you know, he's got his shirt off and ready to throw me. What is it, Sam? Hey, come on, Sam, throw me. Show me how you throw a person. And then, you know, trying to teach Charlie how to fight, I guess, is the...
Yeah, you know, he's there for training.
Dudes,
you know,
being dudes, yeah.
He's just kind of, it's totally a guys being dude scene. I do love that it this is a recurring thing for the first couple of episodes. I think it's throughout the series. Every kind of, like, other crewman who's just kind of in the background of stuff definitely looks like he was smoking in the background somewhere. Like, all these dudes... just look hard as shit, like just run over.
I don't remember if it was this episode or maybe the one before it that like is just an incidental character that Kirk like grabs and gives an order to, is like super receding hairline and like hair slicked back and like craggy looking face, like you said, like he looks like he smokes two packs a day. he looks like he was like a guy building the sets and they just grabbed him and were like, hey, you be an extra here.
Like which he looks like he wears a short sleeve dress shirt and a clip on tie to work.
Sure.
But also,
or like a white t-shirt with like a pack of cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve or something.
And that guy's up against the wall pulling on two levers working out. And while the there's apparently a do somersaults tube that it's all the other people are just doing handstands through, which is also great. You know, just do your handstands through this gymnasium. It's a cool gym.
Hang on, I need to know what the legendary scene is.
Oh, this is the scene.
Well, you're also talking about the gym scene.
Is legendary specifically because of Kirk in the tights. Like that it's just everyone loves that one. But I was thinking more of the,
the
mess hall.
Yeah.
Spock with his harp.
Yeah.
And Uhura just doing her fucking improv lounge act.
I was not expecting any of this from this show.
Here's the thing. This is the coolest you could be in 1966. Like, Leonard Nimoy and Nichelle Nichols here, no one could be cooler than what they were doing in this scene.
Okay, her tune has, my notes say here, this musical number is very sci-fi Ren Faire. Like, it has, like, a very, like, He went along to do, you know, very
he's playing
green,
a space
please.
Harp.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The whole
a bard like quality.
Yes, yes. As she's kind of riffing and kind of ribbing, you know, on Spock and, you know, like goofing around. It's fun. It's a fun scene.
Oh, on the Starship Enterprise, there's someone who's in Satan's guise, whose devil ears and devil eyes could rip your heart from you. At first his book could hypnotize, and then his touch would barbarize. His alien love could victimize and rip your heart from you. And that's why female astronauts, oh, very female astronauts, we terrified and overwrought to find what he will do. Oh, girls in space, be wary, be wary, be wary. Girls in space, be wary. We know not what he'll do.
It is. It's great. And it's legendary because, again, Spock playing the harp is amazing. And I think Nichelle Nichols, it's like, oh, shit, she can sing.
Yeah.
Like, she's actually talented at singing. Wow.
Then Charlie comes in, though, and she starts singing about him. And then I was like, oh, don't do that, please.
Oh,
like, there is definitely a good, sinister quality they build up around him. Like, a real like, predatory.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's pretty unsettling, honestly, because, like, he clearly is, like, making eyes at the women on the ship, and you realize that he's all powerful.
He's
yes.
basically and, like, an incel.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Kind of, yeah. But one with magic, like
with
unstoppable magic
powers.
Like it's genuinely pretty creepy.
Yeah.
Does not like being the butt of a joke.
No. And does not like not being the good center of attention. He wants to be everyone to pay attention to him, but because he's so cool, you know?
It goes on to do one of the creepiest card tricks I've ever seen.
Yes, card trick. When he does that card trick, it was about the point where I was like, oh, this is not,
this is not going to go well.
I don't like this.
Picks four cards, puts them, then shows the cards, and then, you know, they're like ace, king, queen, jack, puts them face down, and then flips them over and are like candid photos of Janice that look like they were taken like while she's working. They're not like posed or anything. She's like just working, but she's like, how did? And people then clap. They're like, oh, that's really amazing. Like, where'd you get these photos?
Well, you're forgetting a key detail here, which is that he took Uhura's voice before he started doing this, and also no one seems to really be reacting to that.
Yeah, yeah. She's just kind of pointing at her throat while
and Spock is the only one who's paying attention.
Yeah, just kind of like, yes, I did forget about that. Yes, poor Uhura. I assume she gets her voice back.
Yes. An undo button that happens at the end of this episode where everything goes back to normal. Presumably all the people who were disappeared come back.
Yeah, well, they say that.
Because things escalate pretty quickly. So
yes.
He goes on to do this creepy card trick, professes love to Janice, who's like, it's just not gonna happen, man. It's not in the cards. It has to go back to Kirk again. It's like, just please tell him it ain't gonna happen.
Let's not also forget the part where Rand tries to introduce him to someone who is supposed to be closer to his own age, which, one, don't understand how anyone got through Starfleet Academy that early, because that girl can't be more than 19, and it's like...
He's 17, they say out loud, yeah. He's 17, so yeah.
So I'm just like, you can't be on this ship working at 17, that doesn't seem right.
But then winds up in the end turning her into a lizard.
Yes.
Which is, you know, before you know everything's going to turn back is like horrifying that she's now turned into a lizard. And then the scene after that, he goes to Janice and is like, I brought you a gift. And I was like, oh, my God, is he going to give her the lizard? That is so messed up. But he doesn't. He winds up giving her, I forget what it is, perfume or something, right? Or some other gift.
Or flowers, something,
flowers,
like,
something like
that.
Melts a chess set. It's my introduction to 4D chess.
Oh, I didn't know they had the like 3D chess in this. I thought that was a Next Generation only thing.
It becomes much more prominent in 10 Forward in Next Generation, but there are at least a few episodes I feel like where 3D chess makes its appearance here, and I've never understood the rules of 3D chess. I never will.
Is it a real thing?
To me. I don't know if it's real or not. I mean, maybe someone eventually made it into a game, yeah, but like
I wouldn't be surprised if somebody went and made up rules just like they went and fleshed out the Klingon language at some point.
Okay.
But the idea here is that like they're, you know, it's the future. They should be playing a future game, and you know, Spock naturally being as smart and good at everything that he is, of course he is a master three-dimensional chess player.
No. No, no. He's too logical, Alex. Kirk, with his illogical moves, beats Spock.
Kirk's devil-may-care attitude. Yeah.
But Spock does beat Charlie, which Charlie does not care for.
No, Charlie doesn't want to learn how to play and just loses and then melts the entire chess set off camera. And then Kirk calls him out on it, and it's just kind of like, hey, man, we all do get mad sometimes. Like, do you know anything about these melted pieces? Let me tell you a little something about love. And then finally has to be like, dude, she's too old for you. It's just not going to happen.
I mean, like, they you know, they quickly find themselves in an intractable situation because, like, he can't be stopped. He's omnipotent and a fucking teenager.
Yes.
I genuinely thought the solution to the problem would be Kirk, like, the power of fatherly shaming.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, I genuinely thought Kirk was going to shame him out of this behavior.
It seemed like it was leading up to it.
Nobody likes you. Like, nobody is ever going to like you if you keep doing this, but...
No,
that's not the exit that they take.
No, so and they start, you know, they start gesturing toward that. But at a certain point, he just stops taking direction and in fact decides that he's just going to take over the whole damn ship and go where he wants, which is Earth Colony 5.
He also goes full Twilight Zone at some point and erases somebody's face, turns somebody.
That's probably the most disturbing. Like, that is that shot just coming in episode 2 is like, fuck, man. That woman just has no face.
Literally just like smooth flesh dome instead of a face.
But also screams, I think. Screams and then runs
muffled,
out, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right. And then turns somebody from young to very, very old. The horror, as that person screams also. It's just going full Twilight. Every Twilight Zone episode, like, wrapped into about 30 seconds there as he's on a rampage, takes over the entire ship. And now somebody please explain to me how they are supposed to sensory overload him?
They come to the conclusion, like, this is kind of very Star Trek. Like, they kind of logic their way out of this, which is that somebody, Kirk or Spock, says, like, you know what? He hasn't disappeared anybody since he took over the whole ship. I think he's at the limits of his power. I think he's got all he can handle right now. So let's just turn on everything else there is on the ship to turn on, and then he'll be so busy trying to keep track of it all that we can try to overpower him.
And surely there are systems on this ship that he does not have to plug himself into in order to maintain his helm control. Mm. But nonetheless, this works because it has to. They're nearing the end of the episode.
I'm going to say this one doesn't really end well for anybody except for the Deus Ex Machina that happens as, like, he's kind of stunned. He's kind of not. Yeah, their idea is like, oh, well, he'll get distracted and then we'll basically keep him sedated. And that's,
like,
the only way.
Yeah, like, Kirk actually does manhandle him a little bit. So, like,
yeah,
like, he is weakened somewhat. But, like, I don't know, like, the one upside of this ending is that it does allow them to show some amount of human. I'm trying to think how to put this, like, human future enlightenment, basically, because the aliens show up. The aliens that from the planet that his ship crashed on show up.
That piece of the aggro crag that they apparently fly in space is there, and a big floating head appears on the bridge.
Yeah, and it's implied that these aliens gave the kid the powers because he was going to die in the crash, and that was the only way to keep him from dying. But they want to take him back. They're like, we didn't know he got out. Like, we're very sorry that he did this. Like, he's coming with us. I did not expect that. Like, Kirk actually jumps in and says, like, no, he deserves to live with his own kind. Like, because these aliens are non-corporeal. Like, they are energy beings.
It's really dark. It's a very dark ending.
It's actually very dark. But, I mean, Kirk can't do anything about it. It's not like they have the power to stop these all-powerful aliens from taking him. But, like, he's, like, screaming toward the end, like, no, you don't understand. I can't even touch them.
Right.
Like, they don't love.
Right.
Like, it's this, like, incredibly cold, like, for a single human to exist in this state of having no, like, physical companionship and no love or whatever is, like, a horrifying fate, and yet they just go ahead and take him back anyway. What?
Come, Charles.
Oh, please. Don't let them take me. I can't even touch them. Janice, I can't feel. Not like you. They don't love. want to stay, 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 stay.
What do they say? They say like, oh, there's no option here. Like if we let him go with you, he'll eventually have to be stopped. You know, like, you know, it just won't work. It's very, very dark and cold. And he's screaming. Like he is like terrified to go back in this, you know, say what you want. Is it a metaphor for like, oh, my real home is horrible. And like, you're my, you know, I thought you were my stepdad's home is awesome. And like, you're throwing me back into this broken home kind of thing. But it's, I don't know, episode just kind of ends there. He like phases out.
All you get is them saying like he will be cared for. You know, like his needs will be met, but obviously they can't all be met because inherently there is just a stark difference between the way they exist in this universe and the way he does.
And they get a reset button, and then like, everybody who has disappeared presumably comes back. I don't know if the other ship he blew up comes back.
That
but,
does
like...
not. I think death they can't bring back, but anyone he sends to the Phantom Zone
or turns into a lizard or takes their face away,
that just gets undone.
The floating head flat out says, "We tried to help the other ship, but there was nothing we could do for them," or something like that.
I have a question for you guys who have seen. So again, I've got a lot of Star Trek through osmosis. These Thasians seem extremely powerful. Is that different than like a Q? Is Q like on a? Is Q like a
so
a god?
The powers are not that different, like except maybe in terms of scale. Like okay. Q, I mean, Q is definitely like very much like a trickster god.
Okay, kind like of a Loki situation kind of.
Where he could like do anything he wanted. He could like he could delete all of humanity from existence with a thought if he felt like it.
And is Q a race of people like alien?
Okay, it's a collective of a species that exists outside our like space time continuum, but they can just plop in whenever they feel like it.
And do we ever hear like are there other Thasians?
Oh, there's all not this particular. I mean, Alex might know of a specific example somewhere. Maybe it's in Star Trek Online, probably. But like, there are all powerful beings left and right throughout Star Trek.
Okay. Okay.
Of varying degrees of power. It's sort of like the Marvel universe where it's like there are powers. There's people who are powerful and there are people who are really powerful, you know, and it's kind of all over the map.
There are basically gods all over the place.
Yeah.
Okay.
By human standards. Yeah.
Because they seem super powerful and like, you know.
This felt like, you know, he had to like really concentrate to remove a single person from existence.
Mm.
Like Q is very cavalier about like I said, like remaking history or, you know, huge swaths of the galaxy or flinging somebody to the other end of the Milky Way or whatever.
Okay. Because I wasn't sure in the hierarchy how this settles out. I just know that people talk about Q as being like very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely another situation of like all of these beings just exist to serve whatever
narrative,
whatever high level theme is trying to be advanced.
But in the case of the Thasians, they seem like they are content to stay on their planet, to be away from the rest of, you know, corporeal existence, and they really only saved this kid because they felt bad and did not want to see a child die on their planet.
It's like not to get way ahead of ourselves or whatever, like one of my low-key favorite episodes of Next Generation is all about an omnipotent being abusing its powers in a moment of weakness, and then like, what do you do about that? Like, abusing them to an utterly horrifying degree.
And it's Charlie X. It's Charlie grown up.
It's...
Do we ever hear from Charlie again? I want to know.
Like, Charlie does not come back.
Okay. I can see Charlie coming around in some like thing later in another Star Trek universe because Charlie seems like Charlie's going to have some problems.
And Charlie also seems like he is determined to get off that planet again if he needs to.
Right.
If he finds an opportunity, he's going to do it.
Yeah. Like, I wonder if they have ways. I guess you would have ways of controlling the powers if you grew up with the powers in a society, right? So, like, hopefully the Thasians have ways of controlling Charlie's powers.
One
it was a very dark, it ended extremely dark, and...
Some of Star Trek ends very dark, like, that. There's not always a happy ending, but, you know, there is a conclusion that is to some degree satisfying, but, like, a lot of, sometimes it's just like, hey, this is fucked, and there's really no good way around this.
Well, I mean, like, the when we talked about the Mantrap, that ends with the species going extinct, but at least there's some sense that, like, okay... This day is saved, at least, right?
This menace is over, and at least none of the principal cast members are dead.
Yeah, and then with Charlie X, it's like, I don't know, this kind of ended with us dooming this kid to this nightmarish existence in a way that is like a sensory deprivation chamber.
Well, they didn't though. Again, that's what I mean. No, they at least right. have the opportunity to show like how kind of evolved they yeah. are by saying like, yes, he's been done terrible things, but like he deserves better than this.
Sure. Sure.
But the thing is also the alien species is right. That kid, no matter how much you instruct him, what if you eventually get him to a place where he stops using his powers, it will have come at the cost of tons of more people and tons more stuff and all kinds of problems that will result in wanton destruction. And, you know, whether it's worth that or not, I think is, to the alien's mind, absolutely not.
They should just wish his powers away. Just wish them away.
Apparently it doesn't work like that. Apparently once they give you the powers, they can't just turn them off.
Also, like, are we not going to explore the part where, like, you can give these powers to somebody? Like, hey, man, like, let's talk. Come back around. Like,
it seems like the Thasians don't want anything to do with what's going on in greater space. That's not of interest to them.
Just kind of fading in and out of...
they just want to go be a big glowing head somewhere.
Well, that was... those were two pretty interesting, let's just say, inaugural episodes into my Star Trek journey. The universe is a really interesting place. The galaxy.
Is. Now, again, we are committed to watching the first season of Star Trek. I am going to give you guys the eject button if at some point you decide you're just not enjoying this experience at all and don't want to do it. But I am enjoying going back through these because I have not watched a lot of these episodes in a very long time.
It feels like a gap I need to fill in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
even,
like,
even if parts of it drag or whatever, I feel like I need to see it just for my own edification.
And like my wife is excited. She's a Star Trek fan and has seen a lot of these. So like she's excited to watch them with me. And, you know, she's got some good commentary for me of like, oh, this one or like, oh, this is a good one, you know? So I'm curious to see.
We're here to talk about the good. We're here to talk about the very bad. It's all over the place in this series, but I'm looking forward to experiencing the rest of it with you guys.
The thing for me, I'll say as we wrap this episode up is, coming to it so late, you know, decades and decades and decades and decades late, I feel like I can look at it and be like, oh, this Mandalorian feels like it's cribbing a lot from this, right? Like the kind of modern Western
in space
seems like, oh, it's kind of even to the point of like the set piece drama style stuff seems like it is taking so. I'm sure this had a huge impact that was just lost on me as I missed this and went forward in my cinema and TV journey. So it's interesting to see, you know, what I'm sure broke a lot of ground at the time for having to do a lot with a little.
It did. And I'm actually looking forward to seeing you guys like just do the fucking Leonardo DiCaprio point at the screen every time you see a pop culture reference that references the specific whatever episode we're watching. Because there's a lot of that in Star Trek.
We didn't even mention it. We got a He's Dead Jim right there in the first episode.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
We haven't gotten any Damn It, Jim, I'm a Doctor, Not a Blank yet, but that will be coming, I think, pretty soon.
Okay. I look forward to it. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, guys. So next time, we haven't talked about yet what we're going to watch next time, but I'm going to just go ahead and make the call right now. As we are doing these on an alternating schedule, we are going to be watching movies, and then in every other episode, we're going to do a couple episodes of Star Trek. Next time, it's time to do a movie, and I'm going to do one that I'm fairly certain I have never seen the whole way through. I have seen bits and pieces of it over the years. I know the pop culture touchstones, but I want to keep it with a theme of what we've done this month. And we are going to watch Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, wow. Okay.
A movie that, again, I've seen pieces of. I know the lore of it, but I have never actually sat down to watch the entire thing. So that will be our movie next time. Guys, have you seen this one?
Yes. Yes.
I'm like you. I vaguely remember seeing it as a child, but it's just bits and pieces in my mind.
Richard Dreyfuss making mashed potatoes.
Yep.
I remember Devil's Tower.
I remember the music.
I remember it being unsettling towards the end and being like disturbed.
There are some unsettling parts of it, and it is, you know, I think it is definitely continues Spielberg's journey into becoming the blockbuster filmmaker as the 70s and 80s go on. I'm excited to see it finally because I've wanted to. And it's appropriate. We watched Jaws, so let's watch the other Spielberg-Dreyfuss classic. Why not, right?
Sure. I like mashed potatoes.
So that will be our episode next week. So look out for that. As always, Brad, Benny, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be back next time. See y'all later.